We'll live as long as our cities do, provided we don't go picking fights with our fellow city entities. He grimaces, putting a hand to his ribs, though he lowers it just as quickly.
Healed at last. If I were home, the bones would have knit in moments.
Just other cities? The enemy can't harm you anymore?
Oh, I imagine he can, now that it has taken this more virulent intent form.
Paolo shakes his head.
The process has been wrong since at least New Orleans. Probably longer. Maybe now the others will finally listen and do something. And I pray it is not too late already.
Something Paolo has said troubles Manny. Have a lot of cities been killed in the process of being born?
Countless numbers over the millennia. More lately.
When Manny's eyes narrow, Paolo half smiles and then begins rummaging in his pockets for a cigarette.
Yes, it is exactly as you think. The deaths are accelerating. I suppose that follows if the enemy has been weakening new cities even before they quicken. What a horrifying development.
It wasn't like that for you. Finding his cigarette and lighting up, Paolo regards him over the faint orange glow before exhaling smoke.
No. There was unrest in my city, certainly. The military dictatorship that had taken over the country. Most likely backed by your country's government, thank you for that. Decided to clean up the favelas by destroying them, evacuated or not. As I was from one such favela, I objected. So did São Paulo, which chose me to become its voice and champion.
Manny sees the memory warm his eyes for a moment. Then Manny recalls that the military coup Paolo just mentioned was sometime in the 1960s. Paolo looks great for a 70 or 80-year-old.
When the enemy came,
Paolo continues after another long, appreciative drag on his cigarette.
He tested my resolve, as was traditional. I and my city met it in the rubble of a shattered marketplace, where I blew its harbingers to hell with a rocket launcher I had stolen from the soldiers.
Manny laughs, startled. Paolo so often has a genteel air. Ah, but there beneath the stylish professional veneer, Manny can see a cold brutality to match his own. He strongly suspects that Paolo did his own share of hurting people back before he became a multidimensional entity.
Did you choose to be different? Manny wants to ask. Is that why the city claimed you for itself?
But just as he opens his mouth, a loud clack echoes throughout the empty old station. It's a familiar clack, Manny realizes. The same thing they heard when the subway train's lights went out. It's followed by more clacks, faint metallic groans, pops like sprung rivets. He's not too troubled by the sound. Some kind of electrical shutdown procedure, probably. Until he realizes it's getting louder, speeding up rather than slowing down. Clack, 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 clack. Silence for a moment. Then Manny hears something new and awful. A low, grindingly slow, distressed metal screech. There is a tinkle of cracked falling glass. He tries to think of what else that sound might be, but only one conclusion feels possible. The train is moving, with no one aboard, and while powered down. The train is moving in a way that no train is meant to move. Behind them. On the platform they just vacated. Paolo throws him a wild-eyed look. Manny knows. He must prepare a construct to channel the city's power. Think of some quintessentially New Yorkish thing, a habit or a gesture or a symbol. Then wield it as a weapon. They stand in Manhattan, upon the concrete and beneath the dirt of his own borough. Manny should be nearly invincible here. But as the clacks and metallic screeching grow deafening, and the thing that has come for the primary avatar crawls crunching and ravening up the steps, Manny finds that amid his sheer and absolute terror, his mind has gone completely blank. Aislinn jerks awake to the sound of shouting right outside the house. Then the whole house shudders as if with an earthquake. Startled, she fumbles first for the knife under her pillow, though Connell is not home, she knows. He and her father are out for the night, her father on shift, Connell, God knows, or cares where. Only her mother is home, and Aislinn knows from experience that on nights like this, when she is left to her own devices, Kendra Houlihan will be deep in a bottle of gin. Aislinn doesn't know if it counts as alcoholism when you only drink yourself into a stupor once a week or so, but, well, Aislinn is effectively alone in the house. So she gets up. She's in pajamas again, but this time she takes the time to put on a heavy terry cloth bathrobe, even though it's hot. While she does this, bright light flashes outside, nearly blinding even through the curtains. Someone, a young woman sounds like, screams in a voice that is high-pitched and revolted and more than a little hysterical. Someone else, with a deeper voice, shouts, rhythmically but breathlessly, like she's reciting poetry while running. "But once on the scene, we start killing kings!" There is another of those house-jolting thuds as Aislinn finally runs out of her room, and the bright light beyond the blinds fizzles out. Something huge and inhuman with a voice like a high-pitched bus horn shrieks, and the sound of this is enough to make Aislinn cry out and cover her ears as she stumbles against the wall, hard enough to dislodge an old family portrait. Her and Mom and Dad, and a teddy bear to represent Connell. Sudden silence. Everything outside has gone still. Her mouth dry with fear, Aislinn hurries to the front door and eases it open. In the front yard are four women and an older man. The man, who is maybe Japanese, is picking himself up off the ground. In one of his hands is a strange bright red envelope covered in gold foreign characters, which he's holding like a shuriken from one of the anime shows Aislinn used to watch. His glasses are spiderwebbed on one side. Of the women, the stocky, short-haired Mexican-looking one stands with her feet planted, crouched low like she's about to do a wrestling move, even though she's old enough to be Aislinn's grandmother. She's also wearing the biggest, ugliest old boots Aislinn's ever seen. The tall, stately black lady is vaguely familiar, though Aislinn can't place her face. She's in a skirt suit that is covered in dirt all along one side, and she's barefoot. On the curb nearby, neatly positioned next to her sensible heels, is a pair of small gold loop earrings. The third woman, who sits shaking on the ground, is Indian and plump and young enough to be Aislinn's own age. She seems all right, despite the shakes, but she's brushing at her own arms as if frantically trying to wipe something away. And above them all floats the woman in white, who glows as if a white sun shines through her skin. There are other things in the front yard, too, moving at the edges of Aislinn's vision. Other things that... She shudders and resolutely does not look at them again. The woman beams over her shoulder as Aislinn steps outside.
"Lynn, my dear, sorry that we woke you. Did you sleep well?"
"What the hell?" Aislinn stares at the strangers in front of her house. They're mostly in the driveway and on the lawn, though keeping well away from the big white tower. But all at once, Aislinn recognizes them. Even though she's never met a single one of them before, she feels certain. She knows them without sight or name as well as she knows herself. The big black woman can't be anyone but Brooklyn. The mean-looking old lady, the Bronx. The nervous-looking Indian girl, Queens. They are her, and she is them.
We are New York,
she murmurs and then flinches. No, they're missing one, because the old Japanese guy definitely isn't Manhattan, although Aislinn senses at once that he, too, is a city. Another substitute, who's standing, or trying to remain standing, since he seems unsteady on his feet, in the flower bed. In Aislinn's flower bed, where she grows herbs and chamomile for her tea. She can see his filthy foreign foot planted square on the dill. The anger comes on faster than Aislinn's ever gotten angry in her life. It is as if Connell has broken a dam within her, and now every bit of fury she has ever suppressed over 30 years just needs the barest hair trigger to explode forth. She steps out of the house and onto the walkway, and there is shimmering, terrible light around her as she summons forth every drop of belonging that her island can give her, which is a whole heaping lot. The foreigner and her other selves all turn to stare at her, eyes widening at the manifestation of her power. They are awed by her, and it's delicious. She bares her teeth. Get off my lawn, she says. What happens next is instantaneous. One moment, they're trampling Aislinn's herbs and the grass that her dad worked so hard to keep neat. Next moment, all four of them have been picked up and flung backward by some invisible force, hurtling them away from the grass and driveway onto the street. The woman in white, who isn't technically standing on Aislinn's lawn, remains where she is. The rest of them land on the asphalt of the street with cries or groans or curses. The woman claps in delight when she sees what Aislinn's done. The other avatars look shocked, except the Japanese guy, whose expression is unreadable as he picks himself up. Queens, grimacing and stumbling a little, helps up the one who is the Bronx. The Bronx rubs her hip, then picks up each of her booted feet, and then puts them down carefully, as if she cannot believe they have been moved without her volition.
That's what you did to Paolo,
says the Queen's girl, sounding both astonished and horrified.
My God, why are you attacking us?
Because I don't know you, Aislinn snaps, and you were standing on my lawn. You know who we are, says Brooklyn.
She's frowning and favoring her right wrist.
You have to by now, and you know what that is.
She nods toward the woman in white.
Yeah,
Aislinn says, offended now.
That's my friend.
You're crazy.
The Queen's girl is shaking her head in disbelief.
Oh my God, you are really batshit crazy. You know what she's going to do to you? To the whole city, if she can?
Aislinn hates being called crazy. Her father says it all the time. All women are crazy as far as he is concerned. She loves him, so she does not protest when he says it. But these are strangers, so now she feels free to hate.
She doesn't want to, Aislinn says coldly. She has to. Sometimes people...
Aislinn's father, her mother, herself... She flinches with this thought, then sets her jaw.
Sometimes people do bad things because they have to. That's just life.
Aislinn folds her arms.
And there can't be anything there in her world that doesn't already exist here. It's just that there, people try to be decent. So maybe...
She falters at the looks on their faces. They're just staring at her as if they don't understand. As if she's wrong. Who the hell are they to judge her, though? Yes, maybe they're the destiny she's spent her whole life yearning for. But it has shown up on her front lawn and trampled her herbs and slapped her in the face with insults and disrespect. And now that it's here, she's pretty sure she does not want this destiny. Destiny is rude and ugly, and maybe
I don't want the rest of the city to be okay,
Aislinn snarls.
Maybe it should all go to hell.
Eyes widen. There are gasps. The Japanese guy's mouth is set in a hard, resigned line. Then the black lady's face contorts with anger and she starts forward.
Now see, what you are not gonna do is leave my daughter to die because you're a selfish, xenophobic little heifer. Come the fuck on here.
The Bronx, obviously having reached the same conclusion, also strides toward Iceland. Both of them plainly intend to force her to go with them. Iceland stumbles back.
You can't. You're gonna kidnap me? My dad's a cop. I'll...
says the woman in white. The two older women stop as the woman in white moves between them and Iceland, while Iceland presses back against her house's front door, panting a little with an incipient panic attack. But the woman in white is smiling as she turns and opens a door in the air. Through an arched entryway is a small cavern lined with black glittering walls. On the floor of this cavern, Iceland can see another young woman, this one chubby and brown-skinned with loose curly hair. She's lying on the ground in this place, and she appears to be unconscious. She's also covered in gross-looking sticky wetness of some kind.
Oh, no, groans the Bronx woman, going still with shock. Vanessa, always check your back seat, says the now grinning woman in white. I used to think that was a euphemism for making sure your ass was on straight. But no, it literally means check your back car seat. You people never make jokes when I expect them.
She sobers.
If you want her back with her shape and sanity intact, you'll leave, and leave me with my friend here.
She turns a winning smile on Iceland.
And then you'll destroy the city, says the Japanese guy.
Naturally. But I'll at least make sure it's quick and painless, all right? We've never wanted to cause suffering. That's your people's way.
She lifts her chin a little.
We can be civilized. You stand down. I bring my city into this world and use it to begin erasing this universe and all of its antecedents and offshoots. If you like, I can create a temporary pocket universe where some members of your species will survive the collapse. Though, of course, without the support of nearby universal branches or a city's power, it will eventually succumb to entropy. But it should last long enough for your brief, unidirectional lives to end naturally, peacefully. We all win. She beams.
The Japanese man scrunches his face in confusion and rapidly growing denial.
What?
But the old woman, the Bronx, shakes her head. Her lips are pressed tight together.
That's not how this fucking works, she says.
You don't get to do this. You don't roll up in here and threaten to kill everything we love and claim to be civilized while you do it.
Oh, my God, says Queens.
She's staring at the girl in the cavern, and her face is distorted with disgust. When Iceland looks into the cavern to try to understand what Queens is so horrified by, she realizes belatedly that the cavern walls have begun to flex in a strange, a rhythmic way. When one of the walls shifts in an odd way, Iceland glimpses something hard and ridged slide out from behind it.
A comb, she wonders. She thinks it's a comb. It's black, like a comb meant for men or black people.
The comb's teeth are irregular and needle sharp at the tips, and they curve a little, inward, toward the young woman. Almost like
teeth. They are teeth, not a comb. Teeth, teeth, teeth.
And the place that the girl lies within isn't a cavern at all. A fold of the glittering, glistening, Iceland realizes, her gorge rising. It is glistening with saliva. Cavern wall shifts aside a little to bear a narrow, vertically oriented throat that vibrates. For an instant, the sound that emerges is not a voice, but a dead flat throbbing tone. It flexes again. It's the ding ho. A ding ho that has the poor girl in its open mouth, threatening to swallow her alive.
You are the most horrible thing in the world, Queen says.
She's crying, but her fists are clenched.
Vanessa isn't even one of us. She's just ordinary. Why would you hurt her?
She raises those plump fists, ready to fight. All three of the other parts of New York are tensing, crouching, preparing themselves to fight the woman in white, to fight Iceland's only friend. Iceland clutches and shakes her head. It's too much. She just wants it to be over already. So she shuts her eyes and clenches her fists and wishes with all her might that every one of these dangerous strangers would just go away. Everything then happens very quickly. The thing emerges from the stairway tunnel slowly, more of a bulging forward than an active movement. Fast, glacial, ghostly in its shifting, fluttering white shapelessness. It's easy to see the bones of the subway train that it used to be underneath what it is now. A living, flexible, snake-like thing covered in a proliferation of white tendrils so thick as to resemble fur. That fur ripples back in waves, pressing against the tiled stone, easing the passage of the train through the narrow archway mouth in the same way that cilia move things through the small intestine. As Manny and Paolo watch, the elongated nose of the train oozes to the side, turning and questing about like a living thing on the hunt, reshaping itself by the moment and finally focusing on Manny, Paolo, and the sleeping primary. Paolo holds a cigarette the way Manny remembers holding a knife. He blows a hard puff of smoke at the train beast, and despite a gap of yards, the thing flinches, its unearthly light flickering momentarily as the tendrils covering its nose die away. Underneath is the metal and wire of the former front train car, now horribly distorted into a bullet-like shape. But after a moment, tendrils from the unaffected portion of the car grow rapidly forward again. The new ones sprout on the denuded nose, and within seconds, the whole thing is as it was before. Then a line seems to peel its way down the length of the thing, and it splits apart from the tip. Two halves of a hole, a mouth, and at their core, a black throat lined with jagged, broken-off subway seats. Paolo curses softly, stepping back. There is fear on his face. Manny flexes his fists, stepping forward, as fear for the primary eclipses any fear for himself. He still hasn't thought of a construct, but there is a growl in his chest. All has faded into a red haze of instinct. He's mine, he snarls. His voice has deepened, reverberating. Paolo throws him a startled glance. Mine! You can't have him! The train monster hisses like sliding doors and spits further. Now it's a mouth in four parts, worm-like and wrong. The lower mouths end in molars formed from the train's metal wheels, now razor-sharp and spinning with manic, devouring speed. There's even a tiny uvula back there, dangling above the wheels, a red pull knob on a chain, behind which a cracked sign reads, Emergency Brake. And, horror of horrors, it is talking.
Stand clear. Closing.
But Manny does not stand clear. He stands to fight. And he is changing too. He is bigger, suddenly taller. He feels his button-down pop loose and his jeans rip as all at once. His head and shoulders brush the ceiling. He clenches his fists and bares his teeth and no longer cares about pretending to be the good-looking, friendly creature others see. All that matters is the primary. All Manny wants, all that he is built to do, is protect him. and as black fur and shimmering city power sheaths Manny's limbs, and as his shoulders broaden and grow heavy with superhumanly strong muscle. He has one last fleeting thought before he becomes, in sum total, the beast he has always been within. I am really going to have to watch some better movies about New York. Then, King Kong pounds the floor and charges forward, fists raised, to do battle. The world ripples around Iceland's house.
Go away!
Iceland screams.
Leave me alone! None of you belong here!
And because belonging is as quintessential to Staten Islandness as toughness is to the Bronx, and starting over is to Queens, and weathering change is to Brooklyn, and because they stand upon Iceland's ground where she is Staten Island, and her will becomes supernatural law, her voice echoes, and the wave of city energy that ripples along the grass and leaves and air and asphalt is like a 1,000 clarion hurricane blast. And then they are gone. Their car is gone. All of the awful, spindly creatures that have been drawing closer around Iceland, their movements too illogical and jittery to contemplate, and their voices rising and falling in soft, inhuman gibbers, are gone. Even the one that held the unconscious girl in its mouth. When it vanishes, there is a faint, startled... But then, Iceland's front yard is quiet and empty again. At last. Only the woman still floats nearby. Because Iceland didn't mean her. Iceland stands trembling in the wake of all this. Her hands loose, her head swimming. She's tired. Exhausted suddenly. It takes a lot, she realizes, to drive away so many parts of herself. But sometimes to survive, that's just what you have to do. She folds herself down into a crouch and covers her head with her hands and sits there on her house's doorstep, shaking and rocking back and forth. After a moment, the woman lands with a light tap of feet on the concrete beside her. Then a hand touches Iceland's shoulder, gentle and warm. Friends, right? Facing the big, scary multiverse together. It's surprisingly comforting. Yeah, Iceland murmurs softly, not lifting her head, although some of her shakes ease off. Friends. She feels that sudden sharp sting again, high on her shoulder, near the back of her neck. The pain of it fades quickly, however, and in its wake, as the woman in white takes her hand away and sighs in satisfaction at last, Iceland feels warmer, safer, no longer confused at all. She lifts her head and smiles up at the woman in white, who smiles back in warmth and welcome. And for the first time in perhaps Iceland's whole life, she no longer feels alone. A whole city cares about her. So what if that city is not New York? Quietly, all over Staten Island, more towers and oddities begin to grow. It is the infrastructure of a different city, laying the foundations of a different world. And now, only one thing can possibly stop it. Chapter 16. New York is who? They reappear in front of the charging bull of Wall Street, collapsing in a pile beneath its bronze nose. Tourists do stuff like this all the time for selfies, so neither the super early morning joggers, it's nearly dawn, nor the cluster of nuns on their way to morning prayers pay them much attention. There lie the unremarked-upon avatars of New York, or 3 out of the 5 at least, panting and dazed and trying to get their bearings after suffering a colossal defeat. Bronca's still a little out of it when she struggles up enough to check on Vanessa, who appeared with them. Young bees seen better days. Her brown skin is more sallow than it should be, and her hair is lank and still wet with something that stinks. It's an utterly alien stink. The waste products of incomprehensible metabolic processes from a completely different evolutionary pathway, bad breath from beyond. But as Branka ignores the stink and checks to make sure Vanessa is still breathing, Vanessa's face scrunches and her eyes crack open. Even then, Branka is worried. She can't see any of those white things growing on Vanessa anywhere. But the poor girl was in Squiggle Bitch's hands, mouth, for a while. As soon as Vanessa sees Branka, however, she groans.
I was headed out of town. I was. Don't start with me.
The complaint eases a lot of Branka's fears at once, and she lets out a weak laugh.
I wasn't going to. Just glad you're alive.
Yeah. Ooh, tombin.
Vanessa sits up, rubbing her eyes.
God, fuck, I thought I was gonna die. Just looking at some of those things. I felt like everything in me was just ready to shut down. They shouldn't exist. That place shouldn't exist.
What?
That's Brooklyn, who is climbing to her feet and ineffectually trying to hide the giant split torn into her skirt. It's nothing indecent, but she's the type.
Nice legs,
Branka says, just to fuck with her. Brooklyn grimaces back.
That place, where Squiggle Bitch is from.
When Vanessa lowers her hand, her expression is haunted, and that's when Branka sees the strain. She's playing it off well, but there's deep, atavistic fear in her face.
It wasn't actually where she was from. She didn't take me there, thank God, because I don't think... It was more like a halfway point where things from both places could exist. That's what she hangs out when she's not here. Except it's wrong, all in itself, yeah? Nothing's supposed to work that way. I just don't understand how buildings could be built like that.
Like what?
Queens asks, before Branka can mom look her silent. Branka reaches up to check Vanessa's forehead and press the back of her hand against Vanessa's cheeks. She's chilled rather than warm and shaking with more than the chill. Her voice skirls higher and louder when she answers.
Like things that shouldn't exist, damn it! All skewy and...
She scrunches her eyes shut. She's trembling so hard that it shakes her voice.
The angles were fucked up, OB. They were all wrong.
If she had delivered this in her usual snarky tone, Branka still would have been unnerved. That Vanessa instead drops it in a high-pitched stage whisper makes every little hair on Branka's skin stand on end.
Okay, no,
she says, taking hold of Vanessa's shoulders and shaking her gently until she lowers her hands and stares at Branka.
Stop thinking about that shit, she says. Some thoughts are poison. You can think them, but only when you've got the strength, or therapy, whichever floats your boat. Till then, right now, close it off. Focus on right here and now.
I don't... Okay. I'm gonna try.
Abruptly, she grimaces, looking around.
Why the fuck am I sitting on the ground? Gross. And
she sniffs at herself, then makes a horrified face.
Yeah, you're very rank,
Queen says, though she's grinning, relieved to see Vanessa's all right.
When this is all over, I'll go home and get you some of that good incense. My auntie will probably send you a million idlis too, once I tell her you ate all of mine.
Vanessa giggles, and Branka feels her relax. But then it's Queen's turn for a haunted look, as she blinks and sobers.
But it is all over, isn't it? Without Staten Island.
I can't believe she did that.
Brooklyn's frowning as she extends a hand to help each of them to their feet. To her shame, Branka actually needs the help. She's exhausted, and her hip hurts, and her back has twinged something awful.
I don't even know what she did. Like, that was Star Trek shit.
We didn't go fast like when Manny carried us out of the center. We just went. She didn't even put us on the ferry. Straight up teleportation.
Branka rubs at the small of her back.
Well, now we know what her super special power is, I guess. Magic xenophobia.
She looks around, then looks around again. Her stomach clenches.
Hong.
They all look. Hong is nowhere to be seen.
Maybe he's gone back to his city.
Queens grimaces.
He did keep saying that he wanted to. Maybe he recovered first and...
I'm gonna hope so.
Brooklyn says grimly.
I'm actually going to hope he's just that much of an asshole abandoning us while we were out of it.
Because the alternative is that the strange, impossible, and instantaneous transit from Staten Island somehow left Hong elsewhere. In limbo, maybe. Or nowhere at all. That's too much for Branka to contemplate, so she doesn't, focusing instead on practical matters.
And where's my fucking...
Oh. Her old Jeep, none the worse for having been teleported across New York Harbor, is sitting next to the bull. There's already a parking ticket stuck under one of the wipers. Well, at least it wasn't towed. She sighs.
Come on, then. I'll drive us to City Hall.
She starts forward, then stops as Queens grabs her arm.
You're not listening to me, Queens snaps. This is pointless. We can't wake up the primary, not without the fifth bottle. What are we going to do? Go there and let him eat us for nothing?
Yes, Brooklyn says, glaring at her and moving around them to go to the car. Either that, or we go back to Staten Island to knock that little dumbass in the head and bring her along anyway. But that'll probably take another hour, and somehow I don't feel like we've got that much time left anymore. Going to see the primary is the next best thing. She slaps at her clothing, finds her phone in a back pocket of the skirt, and then grimaces.
I don't have Manhattan's number. Why the hell didn't we exchange numbers?
He's underground anyway, so reception would be iffy,
Branka replies. She finds her key fob and unlocks the doors.
Do you just want to die then?
Queens, not following them, looks from one to the other in disbelief.
Are all of you crazy?
Yeah, we are,
Branka says with a single weary laugh.
We're in New York, remember? We're all fucked in the head.
Can't talk too much shit about Manhattan, really.
I'm not giving up, Brooklyn says to Queens. She puts a hand on her hip. Her expression is implacable. Don't you dare try to make it sound like that, young lady. Giving up is what you're doing. So go on, run back to Jackson Heights and hide, and hope that woman and her monster things don't get you. Or leave town. And we'll all hope the next queen steps up to try and save people. At this, Queens flinches.
I want to save people. You think I don't? But we don't even know if this will work.
And then she trails off, wincing. Her shoulders sag in defeat.
But, oh shit.
Branka has managed to get her hip to stop hurting, which feels like a victory.
What?
Vanessa has peeled off the light sweater she had on. Last night, a lifetime ago, she'd been complaining that the center's air conditioning was too much. The sweater is now smeared with God knows what, so she leaves it on the ground under the bull's nose. Sniff that, capitalism. Then she, too, heads for Branka's car.
I was just thinking that you've run the numbers.
Queens is looking at them sadly and smiling.
I guess I should have run them too, but all of this has been too much.
It's there in the probabilities, though, right?
Running means we have zero chance to save the city.
Trying to talk sense into Staten Island, non-zero chance, but so small as to be meaningless.
Trying to wake up the primary?
even with just the four of us, is the best chance we have.
She shakes her head, then finally sighs and starts toward Bronca's car.
I hate that there's no 90th percentile scenario, though.
Yeah, sucks, don't it?
Bronca claps Queens on the shoulder, and they all get in. Brooklyn's phone is down to a sniff of power, but it warns that there's been some kind of police incident at the Brooklyn Bridge City Hall station. She calls one of her magical aides and makes arrangements. Someone from the Transit Museum's gonna meet us, she says as she hangs up, then tosses her phone onto the floor. They can let us into the old station.
I do have a car charger,
Bronca says, pursing her lips at the dying phone.
Leave it,
Brooklyn says, turning to look out the window. I'd only call my daughter again. Bronca sighs and thinks, I really hope they don't name my grandchild something corny. At City Hall, parking is a nightmare. It takes half an hour to get there, even though it's not far. They might have walked faster, even if they'd stopped on every corner to watch the sunrise. The traffic has likely been caused by the weird white structures that seem to be sprouting all over the city now at a rapidly accelerating rate. Bronca drives past a gnarled tree-like thing with yawning, distorted faces in lieu of bowls, which has webbed up the little park between two financial services corporate headquarters. There's another small one on the south lawn of City Hall Park, like a white humped frog without legs or eyes. Just a mouth and warts, rooted to the ground and shivering as if it's cold. Worse than the structures are the people. More and more of the financial and political warriors Bronca sees have tendrils growing somewhere on them. Some have just one or two, but a few are covered in the things, like albino Sasquatches strolling along in Manolo Blahniks.
Getting worse, Vanessa says unnecessarily.
Yeah, noticed,
Bronca replies. She feels Vanessa turn to stare at her.
You know she's like you, right? A city? Just not from this world?
Bronca sighs, questing briefly for a parking spot before finally grabbing a narrow slot that's very likely going to get her towed. Fuck it.
Yep. Notice that, too.
And you know she wants to come here. That's what those white things all over the city are about.
She called them connector pylons. Vanessa grimace smiles. She's trying to connect herself to us.
Bring her city here, right on top of New York.
What? How? Asks Brooklyn. Bronca shuts the car off, so thrown that she forgets to put it in park first. The engine chugs to a halt with an aggrieved sound.
I don't know how, but have you noticed the shadow?
Bronca stares at her. Brooklyn frowns, then abruptly gets out of the car looking up at the sky. She swears. Bronca does the same, aware of Queens scrambling to follow. There's nothing to see, she thinks at first, except unoccluded blueness. It's a typical June morning, with the sun almost seeming to leap above the horizon now that the dawn has broken. Except. Bronca frowns around, noticing at last that the ground is shady. The trees and people cast shadows, but these are thin, almost blended in with the general lack of light. It's a bright morning, or it should be. There isn't a single cloud in the sky. The sun's light should be saturating this area, turning all the shadows stark. It isn't, though. And Bronca suddenly suspects that if she could get up high, she would see the whole city shadowed, as if there is something floating above it, something vast and terrible, but thus far observable only via its effects on the world. Soon, though. Vanessa has gotten out of the car. She's resolutely not looking up, Bronca notices, afraid of seeing something else that she shouldn't.
Yeah, so, she says, her voice tight. You guys should do everything you can, fast.
Yeah,
Bronca's getting that impression. They find the entrance to the old station, an unobtrusive green-painted thing, incongruously labeled Broad Street Subway Exit Only, and locked with a pull-down shutter. There's a harried-looking young man waiting there. He's barely pubescent to Bronca's eyes, which makes her figure him for the summer intern.
Ah, Councilmember Thomason,
he says as they arrive, smiling and stepping forward to shake her hand.
Thank you, we got your message. Will you be needing a tour guide? We don't have any of our usual guides on hand, I'm afraid, but I can.
There's no need, Director, Brooklyn says smoothly. Thank you. I've been on the tour before, I can handle it. We didn't bring a flashlight, however.
Oh, take mine.
He, the director, to Bronca's astonishment, damn children everywhere these days, hands Brooklyn his flashlight. It's one of those survivalist dealies that needs to be cranked instead of having batteries, but this one's fully charged.
And how long will you be?
Not long. I'll be sure to return the keys by tomorrow morning. Brooklyn extends a hand. The director blinks.
You...
I didn't realize.
Now he looks around at the rest of them, wondering, Bronca guesses, why a city council member has shown up with a bunch of raggedy, dirty, tired-looking people to go exploring a defunct train station.
I'll make sure my friend on the Brooklyn Museum Board knows how helpful and professional you are,
Brooklyn says, with a perfect, shit-eating smile. Bronca almost admires her for it. And the director, who apparently wants a better job, is helpless against it. He sighs as he hands over the keys. They exchange a few more lines of friendly small talk, which are aggravating to hear while the city grows steadily dimmer. Now Bronca can't tell her own shadow from the general gloom. Finally, though, the child bureaucrat leaves, and Brooklyn starts wrestling with the shutter lock. After a moment, they're inside, down some steps and around a corner, and then they all stop in shock. Strewn across the curving platform beneath an arch lined with gorgeous Guastavino tilework lies the scattered, twisted corpse of a biomechanoid monster. The bulk of it hangs off the subway platform, and as Bronca stares, she belatedly realizes that the back end of the thing is an unadulterated subway train, the last car of which still sits on its track. All the cars ahead of it, however, have jumped the track. The foremost cars have actually come up on the platform and transformed into something more like an annelid than an inanimate vehicle. It has tiny, stumpy legs made of twisted engine parts. It's also covered in white, glowing strands that have grown as thickly as dense fur. But all of the white strands are dead, Bronca sees with some relief, crumbling away to nothingness even as she watches. She gives the strands a wide berth anyway, while they pick their way around the train's remnants. In fact, Bronca sees that the thing hasn't just died. It has been killed. Ripped apart, in fact. Part of the first car lies crumpled on the other side of the platform, flung against the wall by some incomprehensibly powerful force. The rest is jammed halfway up a side tunnel of the station, but just beyond the jammed-in bit. Bronca can hear someone panting.
Hello?
There's a curse in Portuguese, and abruptly Paulo appears in the narrow gap of the torn-out conductor's cab.
Thank God, he says, his eyes widening with relief. You start an island with you.
They start climbing over the debris. Bronca's ashamed to need a hand from Queens, but she makes it.
No, Brooklyn says, she didn't like us any better than she did you. The woman in white had already...
She trails off. Bronca gets through the torn-up piece of subway monster and follows her gaze to see Manny slumped against the wall. He's the one who's panting, plus visibly exhausted and bloodied all over. He's also completely naked, although Paolo's jacket covers his lap.
What?
Branka says, dazed.
Train monster,
Manny replies.
Yeah, what I mean is...
Stalin Island,
Pablo snaps. He's shaking his head in disbelief.
You're saying she's thrown in with the enemy completely? Does she understand?
She understands.
Queens has gone over to help Manny up. On his feet, he looks like Branka feels, bent over and holding himself gingerly against the pain of any possible movement. He's clutching the jacket over his dangly bits. So Branka figures, Paolo is not gonna want that one back.
And then she threw us off the island.
We
don't know where Hong is, by the way.
Paolo stares at all of them, speechless in his horror. Manny sighs, then turns and stumbles towards something in an alcove beyond them.
We'll have to do what we can then.
And if it isn't enough?
That's Brooklyn.
It'll have to be enough.
Manny's so obviously hurting that Branka goes over to try to help him. Her back seizes up the instant she bends, though, and she has to quit. Vanessa shakes her head and runs over to both of them, glaring at Branka till she backs off. Vanessa slides a shoulder under Manny's arm.
Will we at least be able to protect our burrows?
Brooklyn smiles in a pained sort of way that makes it clear she knows exactly how fucked up the question is. Branka doesn't blame her, though.
How should I know?
But then, so that she doesn't sound completely heartless, Branka adds more softly,
Did they get out, your father and your girl?
I hope so.
Brooklyn turns away then and heads toward the alcove, moving more briskly than is strictly necessary. Branka limps into the alcove as well to behold the primary just as the portrait depicted him. Too slim, too young, and entirely too vulnerable here within the fading light of the city.
Doesn't look big enough to eat more than a couple of mouthfuls of each of us,
Branka quips.
No one laughs.
Paolo comes over and takes Veneza's arm, pulling her back, much to Branka's relief. Then it's just them and the primary. 4 out of 5 stars. Good, but not great. Branka takes a deep breath, waiting, trying not to be afraid. She finds herself watching Manny, though, who seems to get this part of it better than the rest of them. Manny, however, just looks troubled as he gazes down at the primary.
Nothing's different,
he says. He reaches out toward the shaved side of the primary's head, but stops a few inches away, as if he is afraid to follow through on the gesture. His expression tightens in frustration, and Branka abruptly sees the scene a different way. His hand has been stopped by something that she cannot see.
What?
There's only one way to know. Branka steels herself.
Let me die as Tunde Ewi lo oksoks kwe ewu,
she thinks.
As Fire Burns Woman, as Turtle Clan, as the warrior Chris always called me.
And then she reaches for the boy's head, too.
Something stops her hand.
It doesn't feel like anything at first, just a progressive slowness until her hand grows still and will go no farther. Queens starts, then stretches out a shaking hand. Hers stops, too. They all look at Brooklyn, whose expression has gone bleak. She knows it's pointless, but because they need her to, she reaches out. Her hand stops on the same invisible barrier. Above them, through the skylight, the daylight fades more. It's like an eclipse, Branka recalls, thinking of that strange, eerie twilight she's seen a handful of times over the course of her life.
Brilaya draws near,
she thinks, and flinches at the welt this whips across her thoughts.
He's coming,
Paolo says unnecessarily. He's looking up. They're all looking up. His expression is grim.
So she's really going to do it,
Queen says, her voice now full of despair.
She's going to. To put a city from that place here, on top of this one. What does that even mean?
That a lot of people are going to die, Brooklyn says. You heard her. Bringing that city here will somehow cause this whole universe to collapse.
How can that be? I don't understand any of this.
Queens groans, rubbing a hand over her hair.
You should have gone too,
Branka says to Paolo. It's useless, but she's never been able to keep herself from saying, I told you so. Probably the biggest reason why she's single now.
Paolo takes a deep breath.
There's a not insubstantial chance that whatever happens will simply push me back home to my city. Until the universe ends, in any case.
Do you think Hong then,
obey?
They all turn, startled. That's because Vanessa sounds dazed. When she looks up, she's breathing harder, her face all over sweat. But she doesn't look ill or faint, which Branka's glad to see, because she doesn't want to think about what it means if that awful creature stung her, or bit her, or poisoned her in some unearthly way. Maybe it's foolish to fret so over one person's life when the entire city is about to get cosmically curb-stomped. But that's how the human heart works sometimes. So she goes over to Vanessa.
Yeah, kid? What?
And then she stops. Vanessa abruptly backs up a step. Branka stops too. They stare at each other, eyes widening.
She is a dirty, tired little thing, struggling in the shadow of greatness, but proud of what she has. Potential is what she's got in spades. And she stretches out stubby little piers and puffs a sunken chest of long-vanished industry and tosses her crown of new gaudy skyscrapers as if to say, come at me. I don't care how big you are. I'm just as badass as you.
No.
Branka breathes, stunned. Vanessa says. She's shaking a little, but she's also grinning.
Man, what the fuck?
What?
Manny looks from Vanessa to the rest of them and back. Queens is just as visibly confused.
Nothing that matters,
Brooklyn murmurs. Her head is bowed. She's already mourning her family. Paolo, however, is staring at Vanessa, his eyes wide with realization. A strange look comes over his face. He scrambles around the newspaper pile fast and grabs Vanessa by the arm so hard that she yelps. Branka reacts immediately, grabbing his arm in turn.
Hey, what the hell are you? Leaving cities aren't defined by politics, he says.
It's almost a shout, so urgently does he speak.
Not by city limits or county lines. They're made of whatever the people who live in and around them believe. And there is no other reason for her to have instantiated here now than...
He gives up on words and yanks Vanessa again toward the newspaper pile. Branka gets it this time. Her hand has gone numb. She lets him go, then hurries to follow. The little room has begun to darken. Part of that is because the museum director's flashlight is starting to run down. But it's also because the sunlight is gone, completely gone. When Branka looks up, she can see blue sky. But it's a dark blue, as if the stars are about to come out. And when she squints, she sees that something is solidifying out of nothingness. An unearthly foundation forming in the air, high above New York. Vanessa resists, Paolo, looking wildly back at Branka.
B, this is freaking me out. What?
Branka bats at Paolo until he lets go. Then she pulls Vanessa into the circle around the primary avatar.
Every single person I've ever met from Jersey City says they're from New York, she says, speaking with low urgency. Not to New Yorkers, because we're assholes about it, but to everybody else. And the whole world accepts that, right? Because to most people with sense,
a city that's in spitting distance of Manhattan, closer even than Staten Island, might as well be New York. Right?
There is a sound building around them, above them, throughout the city.
A rumble would come from the earth. This is a low howling siren, like a choir of 10,000 voices screaming at once, or no, like wind howling as it is displaced, shoved aside so fast that the air grows hot.
Branka has not heard anything like it since Hurricane Sandy's freight train blasts of destruction, and this is much worse.
Relia comes. But the others get it now. Even Vanessa, who's staring at all of them. Tears have welled in her eyes. She's grinning, elated, because, Branka realizes very belatedly, this is what she's hoped for. She's been with them since the beginning, after all, watching and wanting to help. Understanding enough to envy, perhaps. And the city of New York, which gobbles up any newcomers foolish enough to want in, has reacted accordingly. It's impossible not to smile, too, even here at the end of the world. Joy is joy. Branka takes one of her hands, letting her love show. They are family now. Manny takes the other, his expression intent.
What are you, young bee?
Branka asks her. She's grinning.
I'm Jersey City, goddammit.
Manny's expression clears finally. He exhales in relief as strange mechanisms within his psyche shift and bring into focus the path forward. They all feel this.
And who are we?
He asks them just as the little chamber goes dark. All of it, that is, except for the light that surrounds the primary on his bed of tabloid tales and buried leads. He's glowing, they see he at last. The light never came from anywhere else. And as they watch, he inhales, stretches, rolls onto his back, and opens his eyes.
We are New York,
he says, and grins.
Ah, yeah.
They are New York. They are the single titanic concussion of sound from every subwoofer and every steel drum circle that has ever annoyed elderly neighbors and woken babies while secretly giving everyone else an excuse to smile and dance. It is this sound, a violent wave of pure percussive force pouring from 1,000 nightclub doors and orchestra pits that slams upward and outward from the city. If it were happening in people's space, there would be a lot of hearing impairments in its wake. It happens in the place where cities dwell, and where rude Relia has actually dared to try to usurp New York's seat upon the world.
Oh, no, the hell you don't,
they snarl, and shove the interloper away. They are methane green sewer fire that races through the streets, unreal and yet extra-dimensionally hot, tracing out grid lines and curbs and searing away every atom of alien universe that has made its unwelcome home on the city's asphalt. Every tower and white structure freezes, then crumbles into nothingness. Office workers who've spent the morning covered in tendrils stop mid-walk blinking as suddenly they are blasted clean. It doesn't hurt. At worst, their skin prickles a little. Some of them sigh and put on eczema cream, then go on about their day. But they have become hunting packs of many-limbed, faceless stockbrokers, as hot on the scent as they are on an insider tip, who crawl along the city's walls and leap across its flat rooftops, grinning with feral teeth. They are stick-figure stick-up kids, scarecrows dressed in knockoff Burberry, who lurk in the shadows to ambush their prey. They stoop out of the sun as screeching PTA helicopter parents, brandishing standardized tests in one hand and razor claws on the other. Their prey is the woman in white as she runs through the city. There are dozens of her they see at last. Many bodies, infinite shapes, one entity, all of her working together and wholly dedicated to the war she was built to fight. But she is a city in the end. Fair Relia, where the streets are always straight and the buildings all curve, risen from the brine dark deep well between universes. And no living city can remain within the boundary of another, while it is unwelcome. As each iteration of the woman in white is caught and rent apart into the featureless, undifferentiated ur-matter of which she is made, Relia quails in fear. She is caught now, helpless between realms, too committed to the invasion to return to the buffer dimension. The towers were both adapters and guide rails for what parts of its substance have already transferred. And as the cleansing wave of New York energy roils outward from Manhattan toward Westchester and Coney Island and Long Island, not a single tower remains standing. Anchorless, Relia will be lost in the formless ethers outside of existence itself if she does not find and claim some kind of foothold. Anything will do. She flails, desperate to survive. Any chance, there. It's so tiny, though. Not nearly enough to contain the entirety of a massive city, but perhaps the whole borough can act as a singular sort of anchor all by itself. Relia cannot come through, but with Staten Island's help, she can hold. She can anchor her substance in this new exurb of itself and establish a commerce of citizens and resources that will keep her alive, for now at least. And in the process, this small, angry part of New York that has chafed to be free for so long now gets its wish. But they, New York's remaining embodiments plus the now honorary borough of Jersey City, they are just fine. We are all fine. Thanks for asking. We're New York. Welcome to the party. Coda. I live the city. Fucking city. Never liked Coney Island. Too many damn people in the summer. Too cold any other time of year. Nothing to do if you don't have any money and don't know how to swim. Still, I'm standing on the boardwalk, feeling wood vibrate under my feet with the kinetic energy of thousands of walking adults and running kids and bounding dogs, and feeling something more intrinsic to my being reverberate in concert with five other souls. My soul's in there, too. We're conjoined now. A spiritual freak show, more than fit for Coney Island. That was what that whole devouring business meant, see? If you can't eat them, join them. I'm enjoying myself in spite of everything. Today's July 9th, not July 4th. This is a day that means something to us. Since New York declared its independence from England on the 9th of July in 1776. Fashionably late, as usual. We've decided that it commemorates almost 3 weeks since we turned into cities. So it's time for a celebration. Still alive, whoop whoop, pass the blunt. Paolo gets off the phone and comes over to where I stand at the railing, and we both relax there for a while. Beyond us, out on the sand, Brooklyn's daughter JoJo is playing Marco Polo in the water with Queens and Jersey. She's kicking their ass, because she's fast and clever like her mama. Queens is having too much fun letting herself get caught, and Jersey's too scared of the water. Can't swim, thinks every warm current is somebody's piss, and every blob of seaweed is a Portuguese man of war to really do much. Up on the assemblage of blankets, Queens's auntie is cooing to her baby while her husband, a small man with an enormous mustache, crouches over a portable hibachi nearby, making something that smells amazing. Bronca is half asleep in the full sun, a broad bronze lump spread out across the cloth. She's wearing a bikini. I don't know where old girl found a bikini that big,
but she's got maximum don't-give-a-fuck mode engaged, and I'm surfing on her bitch wave. No idea why so much of me is apparently female, but I'm down with it. It's so me, and I am them. Manhattan sits on the blankets, too. He's been swimming, but has mostly dried out by now and is just watching the others vicariously enjoying their pleasure. Part of him is still so much the newbie, amazed to find this place of sand and sun stuck onto the ass end of the greatest city in the world. But the rest of him has relaxed into acceptance already. He's zen like that. Then I see the muscles in his back tense just a little as he senses my attention. Most people would ignore it, but not this guy. He twists around to look at me, and I'm the one who looks away, unable to meet the intensity of his gaze. I never asked for a knight, an enforcer, whatever the fuck he is. But of them all, I know that he is the one meant to serve me. Which sounds way too damn BDSM for my ass, and I don't know what to make of it. He will kill for me. He'll love me, too, if I let him. Jury's still out on that, because I never wanted a fuck-shit-crazy light-skinned Ivy League boyfriend. Like, I mean, he's nice to look at, but the rest? There's reasons I haven't done the rest for a while, except as pretend. His eyes lower a bit. They all know me. We all know each other. But he's the one who's most sensitive to my moods. He gets that he makes me nervous. He also gets that I don't like admitting that it's nervousness. So he backs off for now. He'll wait till I'm more comfortable with the whole thing. Then somehow we'll figure it out. I sigh and rub my eyes. Paolo lets out a breath of amusement. It could be worse. Yeah, we could all be getting gnawed to pieces by non-Euclidean ding-hoes. I get that. Still. This is some what the fuck, man. It's you, whether you like that or not. He sighs, watching the others, looking entirely too smug with himself. He's better now that I've purged the part of myself that didn't want him. It means that he's no longer unwelcome in New York. He's got serious shit to talk about, though. The other cities on the summit are astonished. Everyone thought you would be like the tragedy of London, but perhaps that was foolish on its face. I cannot think of two cities more different than this one and that one. Yeah, I get it, yo. He still talks too much. I straighten and stretch a little. Manny looks again, his gaze hungry before he turns away, such a gentleman. Your boy in China, okay? Hong is not my boy, but yes, when he recovered from suddenly finding himself back in his home city, he called the others to meet in Paris. New York as well, now that you have become a full-fledged city. The summit will need to speak with all of you and discuss. He sighs and gestures around at the beach, the sky, the high rises behind us. And then he looks across the water. This isn't the touristy part of Coney Island, so even though it's a gorgeous summer day, it's not too crowded. Technically, we're in Brighton Beach, except the beach part is still called Coney Island, which makes about as much sense as keeping that name when Coney hasn't been an actual island for 100 years. Anyway, we're at this end of Coney Island for a reason, see? From here, you can see a long stretch of Staten Island. There's not much of it, mostly flat on this side, trees and elevated houses, the island's low profile interrupted by the occasional industrial crane or cell signal tower. Pretty boring. All of this, however, sits in a deep well of gloom. There are no clouds overhead. No satellites, no eclipses. No one's reported on it in the news, though we've seen a few people commenting on it in social media as a curiosity more than anything else. Only we can see it easily. Us and those others throughout the city who have been granted the gift, curse, of its sight. No big deal. Just a huge, perfectly circular,
Brooklyn took a helicopter ride across the harbor and told us that part. Shadow over Staten Island.
Yeah, just like that. She has betrayed us more completely than we ever believed she could.
Paolo straightens away from the railing.
My flight leaves in a few hours. I'd best head to the airport.
It's out of nowhere. I knew it was coming, of course. He only came here to see me through the change, the next youngest city helping the newbie, and now his duty is done. Still, I bite the inside of my cheek and try not to show how hurt I am.
My sublet is paid through the end of the month. If you want to remain there, just leave the keys and close the door when you go. Try not to make a mess.
I sigh.
And after that,
back out on the street. At least it's summer.
After that,
he says, looking meaningfully from me to the people sitting on the beach before us,
you have 5 other cells to take care of you instead of me.
It's gentle. I've had worse breakups. This probably doesn't even count as a breakup. Still, I fold my arms on the railing and prop my chin on them, trying not to resent my other selves.
Take care of me, Paolo said. They need you, Paolo says. This too is gentle.
To live.
He shakes his head. To be great. I'll see you in Paris.
Then he takes out a cigarette, lights it up, and walks away, just like that.
I gaze after him and don't miss him. And then I gaze at the others and don't want to be with them.
But we're all New York. New York is so full of shit sometimes, and nobody knows that better than New York. So Queens comes over first, laughing and dripping from the sea, to grab my arm and complain that I must be too cool to walk on sand like everybody else, until I finally give up and let her pull me off the boardwalk. And then Jersey City. She prefers Vanessa, so we use that name, but she's also Jersey City. Runs over and hands me a foil-wrapped sandwich of some kind because she says, I'm sick of feeling how hungry you are. You need to eat more.
She pulls me across the sand to the blankets.
The sandwich is good. Chicken kebab. I'm not supposed to get hungry anymore, Paolo said. But New York is always hungry. When Jojo flops down and sprinkles all of us with water, Brooklyn wryly hands me a paper towel to wipe my face. Then Bronca tells me to lie the fuck down because I'm shadowing the sun and she's trying to soak up enough light and warmth to get her through next winter, even though that's like 6 months off. When I sit down, Manny moves aside to make room for me, but he stays bodyguard close, also near enough to touch, if I want, when I'm ready.
Welcome back,
he says. Handing me a Snapple from the cooler. Pink lemonade. Probably just chance that it's my favorite flavor.
No place in the world that can compare, I say.
And we all smile with the magic of this truth.
This has been a Hachette Audio production of The City We Became, a novel. Written by N.K. Jemisin. Read by Robin Miles. Produced and directed by Elise Green. Recorded by Michelle Figueroa. Post-production by Gabino Reyes. The City We Became is also available in print and digital formats from Orbit, a division of Hachette Book Group. For more Hachette Audio productions, visit us at hachetteaudio.com. Thank you for listening. Text copyright 2020 by N.K. Jemisin. Audio production copyright 2020, Hachette Audio, all rights reserved. Hachette Book Group supports the right to free expression and the value of copyright.
The purpose of copyright is to encourage writers and artists to produce the creative works that enrich our culture. The duplicating, uploading, and distribution of this book without permission is a theft of the author's intellectual property. If you would like permission to use material from the book, other than for review purposes, please contact permissions@hpgusa.com. Thank you for your support of the author's rights. This audiobook is a work of fiction. Names, characters, places, and incidents are either the product of the author's imagination or are used fictitiously. And any resemblance to actual persons, living or dead, events or locales is entirely coincidental.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.